Good morning. Welcome to Deadly Days, Tales of Dark Fantasy. It's hard to wrap my head around that this is episode 25. So we're doing pretty good. And let me tell you, there's lots more stories where this came from, because I'm still translating these stories. I just published book three of Hans Heinz Ewer's short stories, as well as book two of short stories by Carl Hans Strobel, and I've got more of those on the coming up. Right now I translate these stories and I publish them, both short stories and novels. If you would like to check out the novels or get a book instead of listening to an audio, go to lulu.com. LULU.com is the publisher that I go through. They have a website there for you can look up my name, Joe Bandel, band like a rock and roll band, EL, or look up the authors like Hans Heinz Ewers, Carl Hans Strobel, or go to lulu.com/spotlight/anarchistbanjo, which is a spotlight where it has literally everything that I have. This fall, I'm going to be working on putting just about everything that I can on Kindle books. There are some of my stuff is on Kindle, but I'm going to try to get it all caught up. Most of these stories come from those two authors, or they come from Der Orchidean Garten, which was the world's first illustrated fantasy magazine that came out in 1919 and went for 3 years. I'm currently working on issue number 18 of those stories that I've translated and published. And also, stories come from Cocaine magazine, which came out in 1923, I translated those stories for Sidereel Press. So there's a lot of selections there, and there's more books there, the novels and novellas. So just putting it out there. If this is your thing, we got a lot of it, and I love this. I love what I'm doing. I realize it's a special niche, but the people who appreciate this kind of literature, they really go for it. And now this story is going to be kind of a long story, so I better get started. It's called The Manuscript of Juan Serrano. On his last South American voyage, Professor Austin Secker, the renowned explorer of the upper Amazon jungle and of the bordering Peruvian Andes, made a most remarkable discovery. He succeeded in finding an old manuscript in the remote and difficult-to-reach cloister of San Esperanza, somewhere in the heights of Mont Blanc. It gave information on one of the many heroes that in ancient times helped in the discovery and conquest of the earth. It was written by Juan Serrano, one of the participants in Magellan's first circumnavigation of the earth, and of whose end nothing had been known up till now. It was only known that he appeared on the beach of the island of Zubu after a bloody feast in which the other participants were slaughtered, and that he pleaded with his companions, who had remained on the ship, for the sake of God and the Holy Virgin, to pay his ransom so that he could be released from the savages. But even though he, wounded, covered with blood, tightly bound, and clothed only with a shirt was such a pathetic sight. And even though the ransom price of 2 rifles, 2 bars of metal, and a length of rope could have been achieved, the commander, Juan Carvajal, refused to free him and gave the command to set sail. Pigasetta, whom we have to thank for a diary about Magellan's voyage, thought that Carvajal left Serrano in the hands of the savages so that he would not have to turn over the command to his captain again. But perhaps it was also because he feared further betrayal from the islanders. In the preliminary remarks, it can be noticed that this took place on May 1, 1521, and that a few days earlier, on April 27, Magellan, on the island of Matan, near Zubu, lost his own life under the spears and howls of savages. Professor Austin Secker was not able to find out how the manuscript of Juan Serrano came to the cloister of Santa Esperanza. One might be permitted to assume that some Spanish sailor at a later time found the manuscript with some natives and was permitted to bring it back from South America, where it came into the possession of the cloister at Santa Esperanza. And now, let us read the manuscript itself in the best possible translation as follows. In the name of God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, Amen. I, Juan Serrano, first captain of the Santiago, and then later the Concepcion, write these lines in the face of impending death, without hope that it might ever be read by any of my countrymen. If, by God's grace and through a miracle, my manuscript should ever be read by a Spaniard or a Portuguese, against whom I carry no grudge, especially since I am Portuguese from birth, he might be able to glean from it how much the devil is able to achieve in the temptation of us poor sinners, how weak we are and how strange our lives and deaths may be. And perhaps then he might say a prayer for my poor soul, if at all possible, in the Church of Maria de la Victoria de Triana in Sevilla, where Magellan received the royal standard from out of the hands of Sancho Martinez de Oliva. After the slaughter of my companions through the betrayal of the king of Zubu, I was led to the beach. But even though I pleaded and begged as strongly as I could, they would not pay my ransom. And I had to watch as my companions set sail and turned the bow of their ship away from land. And this happened even though Juan Carvajal was my godson and had sworn with upraised hand on the memory of his mother and on the wounds of Christ that he would not deliver me to certain death on this island. When I saw that my pleas were not able to make them come back, I fell into a terrible rage and despair and began to curse Spain, my companions, and myself. And I asked God if he, on the earliest day of judgment, would hold Juan Carvajal accountable for the condition of my soul. And I also hoped that my curse might soon bring sickness and death to this horrible and criminal man, my godson. So I remained behind alone on the island of Zubu and was once more led into the village by my captors, so that their king could decide what to do with me. And there was a large crowd of people around me, of women and children, who threw dirt, shells, and stones at me, beating my face and forehead bloody. I was determined to show these people that I was not afraid, was prepared to die, and walked upright between my guards. So we came to the large hut of the king, where the banquet had been arranged and where we had been captured. A number of stakes had been driven into the earth around the hut, and the bodies of my companions had been impaled upon their tips. As we entered, I saw the king lounging on his bed, and near him was a human body lying stretched out on the ground. In passing, I recognized Duarte Barbosa, who, like me, had only been wounded in the capture. The body of my companion was cut open so that I could see the inside of his belly and intestines. The king kept putting both hands into the body cavity, tearing out fistfuls of fat and shoving it into his mouth. But Duarte Barbosa was still alive and moaned and whimpered so pitifully, and as he looked at me, he begged me by all the saints and eternal salvation to kill him. But he could just as well have been begging a stone or a rafter in the hut, because my hands were tied, and there was even another rope tied around my arms, which was tied so tightly that I thought my shoulders would pop out of their joints. I really can't leave it unmentioned that Duarte Barbosa himself had inflamed the hatred of the savages, which I must call them, even though they have all received the holy baptism, by much too strongly chasing after the women of the island, as was his way. And they had been much too willing this as well. This rage of the savages had not broken out before, because Magellan had kept them subdued with his look and his words. In the meantime, the king turned to me and said a few words in his language. Then Henrique, Magellan's slave from Malacca, stepped up. He had followed his master from Portugal and Spain, and after that almost all around the entire earth, until he was once more near his homeland. But after Magellan's death, he had fallen away from us. Henrique, who understood the language of the Zubu and served as our translator, translated the words of the king to me, in which he said that I could see from the behavior of my companions how disloyal and traitorous the people of the Spaniards were, and that they had left me behind out of fear of him. That irritated me, and I contradicted him, again through the mouth of Henrique, and said that he himself had given the worst example of disloyalty and betrayal, when he had sworn an oath to Magellan to be obedient and subservient to the King of Spain. He had, through God's gracious providence, received holy baptism and renounced his former pagan name, Raja Humabon, and replaced it with the proud name Carlo, after our Royal Majesty, which he himself afterwards appeared entirely unworthy of. So much so that I could do nothing else despite his baptism than consider him a despicable heathen and idolater. At that the king only grimaced and replied that his Royal Majesty Carl V was of no concern to him. He did not care, and I only had to look over at my companion, Duarte Barbosa, to see what was going to happen to me next. Then he clapped his hands and two girls entered. They were only clothed with little skirts of leaves around their hips and wore veils on their heads. One of them held a knife of stone in her hand and slowly danced around the bloody body of Duarte Barbosa until the king gave a signal, at which she knelt down and plunged the blade of her knife into the heart of the poor man. His whimpering immediately ceased, and I offered up a prayer in the name of my patron, as thanks that Barbosa was finally released from his suffering. I was led out of the hut. As I passed the stakes with the bodies of my companions, I counted and found that there were 21 of them. It immediately occurred to me that one was missing. 27 of us had come ashore, and of these, Juan Carvajal and the ship's master-at-arms had immediately returned, because they didn't trust these creatures. Henrique had gone over to the enemies. Barbosa would still lay in the hut. I was still alive, and apparently the 22nd must be as well. I didn't have time to notice or determine anything else because I was quickly led past and thrown into a hut, where they tied me so tightly to a post that the blood was soon oozing out from my skin. Toward evening, the so-called Henrique again came to me, sat down across from me, and began to tell me how they were going to kill me and how much the population of the entire island would enjoy this celebration. At that, his eyes glowed so terribly and his features became so distorted that it seemed as if Satan himself was looking at me. And then he told me how he, with the help of the four remaining kings of Zubu, had arranged the treachery and given Raja Humabon counsel, and how happy he was to finally have his revenge for being taken away from his homeland and for his enslavement. That was when I realized that this slave as well, even though he had long since been baptized and wore a Christian name, was nothing other than another heathen. He left me at nightfall, and two girls came into the hut. The first was the one that had killed Duarte Barbosa. They sat to the left and to the right of me with their stone knives in their hands, and I understood that they were designated as my guards. But in front of the hut, I could still hear the voices of the men and knew they were being very careful to prevent an escape. But I was so weak from the loss of so much blood from a blow over the head which I had received, one that had nearly crushed my skull, that I could not even once think about making an attempt for my freedom. Because I was so weak, I soon fell asleep despite my bonds. And a good dream showed me the beautiful city of Sevilla, and I went with Donna Mercedes across to the church of Santa Maria de la Victoria. Once Donna Mercedes lifted her hand and caressed me so softly and lovingly over my face that I became highly confused and wondered why she did this. But then I awoke from harsh screams like the screeching of a giant bird, and as I came to my senses, I noticed two things: that these screeches were coming from above my head at the top of the hut, and that a soft and warm hand was still lovingly caressing my face. But there was so much darkness in the hut that I could not make out whose hand it belonged to, except that it must belong to one of my guards, because no one other than a woman is able to caress so softly and lovingly. Meanwhile, the cries from the roof continued, and they were such horrible and uncanny screeches that the dogs around the hut panicked and began to howl, as if in fear. It was not long before the caressing stopped, and both girls spoke to each other in the darkness. Then they began a soft singing that penetrated miraculously into my heart, strengthened my soul like a sweet refreshment, and almost drove tears into my eyes. As the screeches on the roof became silent, and only this song continued, a deep sleep soon came over me and didn't leave until the light of morning. With sunrise, my guards left, and in their place came four of the king's warriors with lances and clubs, who tested my bonds to see if they had been loosened. Henrique brought me some bread and a roasted hen, which he pushed into my mouth piece by piece so that I could eat and regain my strength, in order, as he said, to prolong my death, which he again described in a horrible way. I ate and refused to give him any response when he once more inquired if I knew where the priest Pedro de Valderrama was hiding, who to his memory had also come ashore. But my thoughts were only directed toward the night that was coming soon, and waiting to see if it would bring any more soft caresses and comforting songs. With nightfall, the darkness came again, as well as both of the girls with the stone knives. Then the warriors left, And so I thought that it must be the custom with these heathens. And it occurred to me that my two guards were perhaps some types of priestesses, like those in many of the tribes in the lands that the Portuguese had discovered. But they only spoke with each other and didn't even look at me, after they had sat down to my left and to my right. The one on my right prepared a drink for me, which she mixed together from various vessels. She said something over it, and then they both drank as well. I was determined not to fall asleep, so that I could find out which of them was friendly towards me. But I had to wait a long time, until midnight, before I felt a hand on my arm. Slowly, the hand slid up to my neck, and I sensed once more the coldness of the stone knife on my throat, so that I was terribly frightened and realized that I was to die in the darkness. But the knife cut the rope that lay around my neck and made it difficult to breathe and swallow. Then the ropes around my arms and legs were cut so that I was once more free, but I didn't move because I thought the same hand that had freed me would give me a signal of what I had to do. After a short time, the same horrible and miserable screeching as yesterday began again on the roof of the hut, and even the dogs began to howl and whine again. In front of the hut was raised a murmur of voices and a clattering of weapons, and then I heard the steps of many men running away into the distance. After a long time, I felt a hand seize mine with a tug and a sign for me to understand. I was to get up, which I immediately did, in order to blindly follow my guide. We crawled through a hole in the wall at the back end of the hut, and I inhaled the night air with great joy. It was so dark that I could not distinguish anything of my guide other than her figure and streaks of white. It was a color with which all the women of Zubu painted their breasts and legs, and which now glowed a little under the free light of the heavens. We slipped away between the huts of the village towards a mountain, until we came to a forest. Here we took a short rest, and the girl began to softly speak. But I couldn't answer her in any other way than in Spanish, and I thanked her for rescuing me. Then we went further, and as we came out of the forest near daybreak, we found ourselves in the light of the just-risen moon and took shelter on a broad, glass-covered plain. In the same light, I recognized my guide as the girl that had sat near me on my right. What happened to the other, I would only learn later, and will only say that what I suspected at the time, namely, that she had been given something in her drink, which she ingested, and it put her into a deep sleep. The travel through the high grass of the plain was difficult and troublesome for me once my head, with its wound, and my swollen feet were exposed to the rays of the sun. When my little girl became aware that I could scarcely continue, she made a rest by running water, washing my wounds and bandaging it with her veil. Then she took some herbs and anointed the irritated places on my feet and wrists with the sap, after which I almost immediately felt more comfortable and stronger, so that I could soon continue on further. On this trail I found many flowers whose leaves were alive. These leaves consisted of two parts that clapped together like wings, and they sat with short, pointed stems on the branches. At the other end, they had a red thorn. When they sensed a human, they pulled away, and a little stick flew through the air as well. And when they were driven into a tight corner, they turned around and stabbed with the red thorn, no different than an animal. But they really were leaves, and I believe that they lived upon the air. Toward evening, we climbed the steep mountain, and at twilight came to a narrow ravine which we had to wander through for perhaps an hour. From this, we stepped out onto a level plain. whose grass spread out in front of us like a carpet. Again, it was so dark that I had to take my guide by the hand. Meanwhile, we came across some stone ruins that looked like pillars or arches, so that a person might think they had found themselves in a destroyed city. Night fell upon us, after which we ate several fruit, which my girl brought from the nearby growing bushes, without a fire next to a large heap of stones, and there I became very tired and only awoke late the next day. As I looked around me, I realized that I had not been deceived last night. We really were in the ruins of a city, with the remains of walls and towers and pillars and fountains. What I had not been able to notice in the darkness was that these ruins and rubble were all of pure gold, so that they shone and gleamed in the sun, as if we were standing in brilliant flames. Now, it was well known to us that this metal was considered common on our discovered island and of little value. Magellan had to strongly forbid us not to seem too greedy for gold or to place a great value on it, so the savages would not know how valuable and expensive it was to us. But I had not thought such an empire possible in these lands. In comparison to the huts of bark and cane down below on the beach, these golden ruins seemed to have been built by another people. And, even though I was no expert, I would venture to maintain that the city must have been built before the great flood. In the rubble there were also many gigantic statues of gods standing and sitting, with eyes of jewels and rings on their fingers, of which one alone was worth an entire house in Sevilla, like the one that Donna Mercedes lived in. As I learned the speech of the land from Salaja, which was the girl's name, I learned from her that her countrymen knew of this city very well, but avoided the area because they considered it occupied by devils. At my question why Salaja had come here with me despite this belief of her folk, she smiled at me and kissed me on the mouth, as I had taught her that that was what the Spanish women did. I must here confess that Salaja had become my wife after I realized that she had taken on all dangers and the rage of her own people because she loved me. And if anyone should find this manuscript, I don't want you to think that I had taken some ugly negress to wife. I must clarify that the women of Zubu were almost as white as our women, that in youth they had smooth and tender skin, and that their voices were very soft and gentle, so that you could listen to their songs with great pleasure. At first, my Salaja wore large pieces of wood in her ears, like all the others, and painted herself with red and white mud. But she put the wooden earrings away and stopped painting herself after I told her once that I was not fond of that kind of decoration. She was compliant and competent in all things, and did everything according to my will, so that I often wondered a little if she really was the one that pushed the stone knife into the breast of Duarte Barbosa. We lived in the Golden City, whose surroundings gave us an abundance of fruit and animals, for a long time without moving, almost for 6 months, unbothered and without having to suffer the rigor of the heavens in this hot and happy stretch of land. And while in the beginning I thought of my own travels in my homeland with longing and homesickness, I later forgot them from day to day, living even more only for corporeal things, just like a plant or animal. And I do not want to say what might have become of me and to what level of forgetfulness the devil might have brought me even further if something hadn't happened one day, which I will relate in the following. But sometimes it seems to me that this early time could not have been under the sign of Satan. And furthermore, that which happened later seems to have been on his instigation and led to an evil game, so that I am now in great confusion and my soul is still in no way clear about what I should make of all these things. That is why I desire this once, just before my death, to raise a sincere prayer to my patron in heaven, so that perhaps death will be easier for my soul, so things will not be so painful, and I will no longer be so full of doubt and confusion. So it was perhaps half a year after my liberation, and we had still not seen any other people, when one morning Solaja had scarcely gone out, when she came rushing back into her house of twigs and bushes. She cried that she had seen someone in the bushes slinking around the ruins. I immediately followed her to a hidden spot, and there we saw a human who crept through the bushes so carefully in the twilight that I only got one glimpse and could no longer make him out. Then I seized my spear, on which I had fastened a blade of stone, to kill this other person if he came any nearer. But as he stepped out of the shadows, I recognized our chaplain, Pedro Ed Valderrama, whom I had believed murdered with the others. His clothing was very torn. His face was framed with a wild beard. But he stood there alive in front of me, and while I was watching him, he looked around and his glance fell upon our golden ruins. Then he sank to his knees and raised his hands high, as if in prayer, at which point I stepped up and greeted him. But he screamed out loud, fell down, and hid his face between his hands, so that I had to speak with him for a long time and tell him that I really was Juan Serrano, his companion. Later I realized that his terror was not so remarkable, since I had not been wearing my shirt during my flight, and after that Solaja had woven me a skirt out of bark and leaves, so that I, with unshaven head, beard, and burned from the sun, appeared like a savage. The chaplain was almost still more astonished over the golden city in which we lived, and that he was over me, and he said that all the riches of previously discovered lands could not compare to these treasures. He picked up clumps of gold and carried them in all his pockets, which he always took out and examined, as if there was not enough of this metal lying around. After we had brought him to our hut, he explained that he had been saved by Silatun, a brother of the king, the same one whom he had brought back to health through baptism and prayer. This man had been very ill when we had come to the island and had not spoken for 4 days. The magicians and priests of the gods could not prevail over the illness, but immediately after baptism and after Don Pedro said a prayer over him, he had felt better and in a short time was completely healed. Out of thankfulness, Silatun had then spared the chaplain's life by leading him to his own house, from where he had then escaped into the forest and later to this lonely mountain. I was overjoyed at finding one of my companions, but Solaja was silent and troubled, as if Don Pedro was not very welcome to her. So much so that I had to console her. During the night after Don Pedro's arrival, I again heard the horrible and miserable screech of a bird near our hut. And when I became aware that Solaja was awake, I asked her what kind of bird it was. But I had to ask for a long time before she would give me an answer. This bird was the grimmest enemy of the whales, And when these came up from out of the deeps in order to sleep with open mouths on the surface of the ocean, this bird would fly down to it, through the mouth, into the innards, tear its heart out with its sharp beak, and kill it in this manner. But its scream was considered unholy, and that was why even the guards in front of the hut had run away that time. When I asked her whether the screech of the bird was such an evil thing to her, whereupon she squeezed my hand and kissed me as only a Spanish lady can kiss. The next day, Don Pedro clambered around in the ruins and came back in such great confusion that I noticed the prospect of so much gold must have climbed into his head. He spoke only of it, that these heaps of gold were immeasurable, and with them a man could buy the entire royal empire of Castilla. That evening he went with me to a high place, from which you could see the plain overgrown with grass, and look out over the endless ocean. "What you could have with all this gold," he said to me, "it lies here unused. We are both the richest men in the world and will never enjoy any of our riches." And he continued on to paint for me how a person could live in Cervella and how all the world would be amazed and serve you. But as I answered him, I declined to dwell upon it because it was not possible and we would never be able to leave this island. To which he replied that he had already noticed that in living together with this woman, I had lost all my incentive. Yes, that I had even forgotten what the best way was, that of Christianity. He could not even imagine that Salaja had never been baptized. At which I replied that was quite possible, because Salaja was clothed with another type of priestly dignity, one that all these people had renounced before being baptized. Then he said that it was necessary for her to take up the Christian faith, because he could no longer endure that I continued living with a heathen any longer, as if in marriage. If I did not ask this of her, she would still fall into hell and be thrown from the grace of God. I told him that I had not done this, because Salaja had saved me from death, and I had not wanted to insult her. Then he said what beautiful gratitude it was that someone who had saved me from death would be given the prize of the spiritual death. And after that I agreed that I would request this of her and persuade her to be baptized. After the words of Don Pedro and my own given promise, I began trying to convince her with all my power to enter into the Christian community. Salaja didn't resist, and said, although a little sad, that she would do what I desired. And so Don Pedro performed the baptism, gave her the name Teresa, and united us well in Christian marriage. After this happened, he began to zealously instruct her in the Christian faith. At the request of Don Pedro, I erected a cross, made two pieces of wood and bound with bark, at a place near the hut. We held our morning and evening services in front of this cross. Don Pedro had brought a painting of the Madonna on a piece of wood and a prayer book along with him when he had come to shore. He had loyally guarded these sacred objects during his stay in the wilderness, and he read to us from out of this prayer book. I will remark at the same time that there were some empty pages bound in the back of the book, the same ones on which you now find this manuscript, which I removed from their place much later. Meanwhile, the chaplain was not satisfied with Teresa's progress in the Christian faith. She was still as stubborn a heathen as always in her inner self, and did not take the holy teaching seriously, especially since my presence distracted her so much that he had to ask me to no longer be present during the hour of instruction. I now wanted Teresa to become a believer as soon as possible, and relieved Don Pedro of the sustained effort and great enthusiasm with which he brought forth threats against her bright soul. I followed his wishes and left him alone with Teresa for the hour of instruction. This led to no better end. One day, as I strolled through the forest near the hut, I heard a loud scream coming from that direction and recognized Teresa's voice. I believed that Teresa had been attacked by a wild animal and hurriedly ran there. I found Teresa lying on her knees in front of the chaplain, who was pressing down on her wrist with his left hand while holding out his right to strike a blow. As I came up, he let his arm sink, but I recognized by his face that he was in an exceptional rage and his anger was so strong that he was not able to speak at all. Finally, he said that Teresa was so opposed to the holy truth, so stubborn and disruptive, that he had lost his Christian patience and been gripped by the impulse to punish her. At this I said, because I found that Teresa understood me better than Don Pedro, that it was for me to punish her. It was my duty, and he only needed to tell me if she remained stubborn and disruptive. I would then find some way to reason with her. But Don Pedro replied that he had given up all hope of making a true Christian out of Teresa and would not trouble himself about her any longer. Teresa had not spoken during this argument, but in the night she moved to my side and asked whether I desired that she should give herself to the chaplain as a woman. Now I knew very well that on the island of Zubu the custom ruled for the host to offer his friends and guests the women of the house. Our manhood had overzealously made use of this custom, and because of it a strong rage had developed in the men because they saw that the women preferred the strangers over themselves. From Teresa's question, I realized that Don Pedro's instruction in Christianity had not gone well, and she was still not able to recognize the difference between being a savage or a Christian Spanish woman. The customs of her own land no longer applied to her. I made this plain, told her that she was now a Christian and must put away the customs of the heathen. Finally, I also told her that as a priest, Don Pedro was a holy man who had renounced sexual intercourse with women. After that, she didn't resist any further. The chaplain really didn't trouble himself very much with Teresa's Christian education after that and remained hard and dark against her. But he became even more preoccupied with the thought of the great treasure in the Golden City. Once more in his daily speech, he spoke of Spain and Sevilla and reminded me of how I could buy old Donna Mercedes, whatever her heart desired. I really had been thinking more than ever about my homeland as well, and a great unrest came over me. We thought of making some kind of plan so that we could somehow leave here. I knew that Magellan had, in his last days, calculated that we could not be far from the lands of the Portuguese. The Islamic merchants who had discovered Zubu and traded goods with the king must have known about them as well, because they had told the king to guard himself against such men as us, as well as any others of the West. We spent many hours talking together in council over what we could do with the help of God and all the saints to win past the Portuguese, who, even though an enemy of Spain, would not leave us in the hands of the savages. The more we considered it, the more we thought that it would not do us any good, and no plan came forward. Even if we were to build a raft without the people of Zubu discovering it, we didn't have any charts and would need to sail without a compass. There was a greater chance of entering the throat of death than of life and our homeland. We stood more and more often on the peak of the mountain and looked out over the ocean to see if we could discover a Portuguese ship. But nothing was to be seen, other than from time to time the sails of the heathen that were out catching fish. During such hours, I could imagine my homeland perfectly, and I thought about Donna Mercedes, who had embraced me at my departure and whispered to me, I must return because our lives were entwined together. Because I thought so much on my Donna and ever more perfectly imagined her features, it happened that one evening I discovered in the Madonna painting, which Pedro held up for me, a great similarity between these features and those of my beloved. We had just spoken more of our escape, and Pedro had pulled out the portrait and held it out for me to kiss. After I had discovered the similarity, he said that he trusted in the intercession of the Mother of God, and it seemed to me to be a good omen for our plans, so much so that I became entirely happy in my heart and began to hope more strongly than ever before. I also told Pedro of my newly established hope, and he agreed with me that the similarity between the Mother of God and my beloved could be looked at as a good omen. The following night, as I lay there sleepless and thoughtful, it occurred to me whether it would be possible to steal one of the boats of the natives and flee in it with some lumps of gold. Teresa knew where the boats lay hidden, and at night she would be taken for one of the women of the village by the designated guards. She could untie one of them and bring it to a place where we could climb in. But when we talked this plan over the next day and found it a good one, Teresa resisted us and would not agree to it. She said that she would never do it. I must here now mention that a great transformation had come over Teresa. While she had earlier always been passionately inclined to speak, she now had become quiet and thoughtful. When we spoke of our escape and our homeland, she crouched on the floor and watched us with a dark countenance. Especially after she realized that I longed to go back to Mercedes, and she clearly showed that she was against our plans. Then, with the newly awoken memory of my beloved in Sevilla, I became increasingly aware of the difference between Mercedes and Teresa, how much softer and lighter my Spanish beloved's skin was, how much more slender her lips, and how much finer and silkier her hair. How easy it was to treasure Mercedes and the strange and exciting love caresses that she knew, which Teresa didn't know anything about. So it came about that I was hard and annoyed many times when these differences were so perfectly presented before my eyes. I also cried out loud to her that she had to obey me and would not even consider letting her contradict me. At that, she stood up and said that she would never lift a hand to help me return to my homeland and to Donna Mercedes. Then Don Pedro began to yell at her as well and exclaimed, how could she dare even take the name of Donna in her mouth? And that, in comparison to the Spanish lady, she was nothing more than the dust at her feet. And to make her feel even lower, he put the painting of the Madonna right in front of her eyes and said that my beloved looked like the Mother of God herself. Then Teresa gripped the portrait with both hands, pulled it close, and looked at it for a long time with a wild expression on her face, one that I had never seen before, not even the time when she had stabbed her knife into the chest of Duarte Barbosa. Then she gave the picture back to the chaplain and ran out of the hut. She didn't come back home for the entire day and was not in front of the cross that evening for prayers, which until then she had always done together with us. She came back later that night, and the next morning I gave her a good talking to and chastised her with hard words. Then Don Pedro showed a great rage over this absence and said that we must now pray even more zealously than ever and use the opportunity to beseech the Lord so that he would not deny us his help. Teresa remained silent and defiant during my performance and immediately ran away, again not to return for the entire day. Then I was seized with a great rage when she again was not present at the evening service. I was of the same opinion as Don Pedro, that it would go bad for us if we allowed this disloyal soul to once more return to the devil. When I saw that I could not bring her to the services before the cross with threats, I hit her with a stick which Pedro had cut for me from a bush. But she stood and let herself be beaten without complaining. And even though I was so anxious to force her into a pious experience through pain, I finally had to stop. The bright blood ran over her back, and even though I was so annoyed over her abhorrent stubbornness, I still had compassion for her. Once more we had to pray without her, and Don Pedro set me straight that through the stubbornness of this heathen, our hopes became even smaller. I said that I would like to try once more to win her back to our side, but Teresa gave me no opportunity for that because she only came back into the hut that night, so softly that she didn't disturb our sleep, and was gone, long gone with the morning light. This continued for 3 days. On the fourth day, Don Pedro came and told me that he feared Teresa had entirely fallen away from the Christian faith and returned to the devil. He had found fresh fruit and flowers in front of one of the idols in the ruins as an offering, and they could not have been put there by anyone else but Teresa. Then he led me to the idol, and I found it was true, as he had said. It was one of the abominable idols with 4 legs and 5 arms, of which the 5th grew out from its belly. On its head it wore a feather headdress with a torn-out bird's beak, and if you looked at it closely, you could see that every feather was held in place by a little skull. Then I was seized with horror that Teresa could believe in such a terrible superstition after she had been baptized. Don Pedro thought that we should hide and surprise her when she came back with another offering. So we lay there in the bushes for several hours until we heard steps and saw Teresa coming with flowers and fruit. We waited until she had laid down her offering and began to dance, as was the custom of all peoples when they want to honor their gods. Then we jumped out at the same time, and Pedro seized her on the arm and dragged her down to her knees. "Miserable idol worshipper," he cried, "you vessel of sin, you bride of Satan, how can you stain your soul that has been purified through baptism in such an abominable way? You deserve to be immediately thrown into the abyss of hell, to be shut out from all grace and mercy." And I added, "How could she give herself so completely into the hands of the evil one, when she had told me herself that her own people believed the devil lived here in the golden ruins?" But she cried in her language, "Really, this belief is true. The devil does live in these ruins, and there he stands." She pointed at the chaplain, who became very frightened at these evil words of the heathen Teresa, and stepped back. But he had scarcely pulled himself back together when he cried that he wanted to drive the demon out of Teresa, and that he had no greater desire, that he could no longer endure such a horrible and fearsome spirit so close by, and Teresa needed to see that her idol was nothing other than putrid smoke and fumes before the breath of the Lord. At that, he commanded me to help him and grabbed onto the hand of the idol and broke it off. After that, we brought some rope and poles and with considerable effort succeeded, so that the statue tumbled to the ground with a dull thud. At first, Teresa covered her head as if she didn't want to watch. Then we went further through the entire ruins and to the horror of God, to the honor of God, through all the idols, 25 in all, down from their pedestals. But during the night, a horrible crashing arose over our heads and a rumbling in the earth, so that the ground began to sway like a ship, and our hut was immediately torn apart. As if the poles were thin reeds, we ran out, and then saw a great flame on the top of the highest mountain, in reflection like blood surrounding us in all the rubble. There was a screeching and a shrieking in the air as if from a thousand voices, as if all the spirits in hell were descending upon us. The ruins of the golden city rolled around each other so that they gave off loud noises as they crashed together. A large boulder fell out from the sky right in front of Don Pedro and almost hit him. Teresa began laughing at that, and it was so frightening to hear that Don Pedro approached her. She was to remain silent and feel the blessed Holy Virgin in her soul. One time we saw a red glowing cloud protrude from the tip of the mountain and rush down over the cliff, and then the cloud balled together and became even redder. It took a course straight towards us and came up so swiftly that we were scarcely aware of the danger as it wrapped around us. It was only for a moment, but we believed we were going to breathe fire and that we were going to burn. Then it was past us, and to our astonishment, we remained unharmed. After this outburst, it became calmer in the air and in the earth, and finally, during the first morning hours, we were able to lie down to sleep. In the morning, with Teresa's help, I rebuilt our broken hut again as quickly as I could, while Don Pedro went out to see what had happened during the night, particularly because the ground was all broken in pieces, with wide, deep fissures and cracks showing. But I had not been working very long when Don Pedro came running up, so distraught and out of breath that I believed he must have encountered something especially horrible. He took me by the hand, led me to a large golden block that lay close by the hut, and asked me to touch it. I did, and it seemed to me as if I grabbed at a yielding mass, and the gold crumbled beneath my fingers, transformed into dust, and trickled down to the ground. And as Don Pedro pounded with his fist against the block, it collapsed entirely and became nothing more than a collapsed heap of ash. Then, after some consideration, I said that this proved we had been wrong, that we had mistaken it for real gold, and it must have been destroyed during the night through some chemical reaction from the glowing cloud. But Don Pedro threw himself to the ground, beat himself with his fists, and screamed so loudly that I thought he had fallen into a fit of cramps. Finally got up, led me to the side, and said that now it was unfortunately very clear and proven without a doubt that this female who lived with us was a wicked witch and a sorceress, which we had to chase away or free her from the demon for the salvation of our own souls. I could not believe this at first, but Don Pedro proved to me how everything hung together, how Teresa herself had at first refused to pray with us, how she had sacrificed to the idol, and how the terror of the past night had been called up with the help of infuriated demons after the pedestal had been destroyed. This was finally followed by the destruction of our great treasure. I had to agree that there was something to his argument and agreed to question Teresa about it. But instead of Teresa answering Don Pedro, she turned to me and spoke. She said that she no longer wanted to conceal from me how the chaplain hounded her with his hatred. She had remained silent up to now to cause no problems between us. But now she wanted to tell me that she hated Don Pedro, and because of that, she was not willing to do what I asked. Then Don Pedro wrung his hands and lifted them up to the heavens. "Brother," he cried, Now you can see for yourself how wide the abyss of this evil cast-off creature reaches, that she even dares place me in shameful suspicion, in order to steer us away from her own shameful deeds. I must profess that these are all stinking, hellish, and low-down lies concocted by the demon that is inside her. I myself was frightened at Teresa's evil shamefulness and agreed with Don Pedro that we must castigate her in the name of the Lord in order to drive the devil out of her. We tied Teresa to a pole and I struck her with a rod. But after a while, Don Pedro said that I was becoming too tired and not strong enough in my blows. Then I turned Teresa over to the chaplain, and he went to work with a great zealousness. After 3 blows from a thumb-sized rod, Pedro held the pitcher of the Madonna up to her to test her, to see whether the devil had left her yet. But Teresa refused to kiss the pitcher. She said that nothing could compel her to show reverence to my beloved. Then we saw that she had still not been cleansed of the demon, and Don Pedro thought that we must use more severe materials. He brought a couple splinters of hard wood with which we started our fire and ignited them. I did not want to watch anymore, even though the good Christ said we must do it, that it was our duty to save Teresa. So I left her with the chaplain, who wanted to singe her a little with the splinters. It was not very long before I believed that I heard a moaning and whimpering. I returned and told Don Pedro that he had done enough. Teresa was burned in many places, but it was still impossible to bring her to kiss the pitcher of the banana, and you could still clearly see the stubbornness of the indwelling devil. Despite that, I could not bear the sight of her wounded back and gathered some of the healing herbs which she had taught me about and laid them on her with a bandage of soft plant leaves. Teresa said nothing, only kissed me on the hand, so that I began to believe that she had regained her senses and perhaps would not resist our request so strongly the next day. But we were to see that Teresa was entirely in the power of the devil. Overnight, Don Pedro had hung the picture of the Madonna on a newly driven post in our hut, so that the Mother of God might spread her mantle upon us and protect us from the evil spirits and terrors that now surrounded us. When it became light and we arose, we didn't see the picture in its place, and found it only after a search among the bushes, entirely broken into splinters and completely destroyed. Teresa's stone knife lay close by, and we were not in any doubt that she had destroyed it. When we asked her about it, she didn't deny her deed in any way. Instead, she spoke with a strong glow in her eyes. She had now conquered her enemy. Then a blind rage came over me because my heart had hung on this portrait, which was our sanctuary, and for me at the same time showed the features of my beloved. And it seemed to me as if Teresa, in destroying the portrait, had also destroyed all our hope of ever returning back to Spain. I could not control myself and beat Teresa with my fists and finally chased her away, telling her that I would kill her if she ever dared to come back to us. Don Pedro had intended that we punish her some more, but I was fed up with the beating and singeing, and only cared about one thing, to not ever see Teresa in front of me again. She stood silent for a while by our bed and looked over at me, as if she didn't understand what I had just said to her. But as I repeated my command with strong words and waved her away with outstretched arms, she turned and left with a lowered head. I climbed to the heights above the ruins, which were even more fallen down, and watched after her, how she climbed down the cliff of the mountain, and then took the path through the wide grassy plain that, to my calculations, must lead back to the village, so I assumed that she wanted to go back to her countrymen. And now I must report something strange, which proves perfectly how powerful the devil is inside us, and how great our weakness is. Teresa was scarcely out of my sight when a great sadness fell over me that lasted the entire day. Even though I kept repeating to myself that we should be happy to have finally gotten rid of this wicked heathen and servant of Satan, and even though Don Pedro had referred to the story of the arid fig trees that needed to be eradicated and thrown into the fire, in the course of the night my sadness became a heavy fear that would not let me sleep, and threw me from one side to the other, until Don Pedro finally awoke and asked me what was going on. I was not able to conceal from him that I couldn't sleep because we had lost Teresa. At this, Don Pedro responded to me that he was heavily troubled since we had chased the woman away, out of fear that she might betray our camp to her countrymen, out of revenge. I knew that Teresa would never do that, but I didn't want to say this to Pedro, because he might perhaps think that I was still too attached to Teresa. But with every hour, despite all objections, the power of Satan overcame that of Christ in me, so that on the following evening, I was entirely confused and sad in the depths of my soul. I thought only about Teresa's fate, and could only imagine the evil and swift punishment that she would receive from her own people whom she had betrayed. I dwelled upon this thought until I could no longer resist, and the image that kept coming to me grew ever more terrible and bloody. Once, during the night, it seemed that a voice called out my name. I sat up, and then at the same time, very close by, I heard the abominable screeches and cries of birds that were tearing out the hearts of sleeping whales. Such a terror fell over me that I almost lost my senses. I jumped up and ran, without telling Don Pedro that I was leaving, out of the ruins, down the mountain, across the plain, and toward the village. I ran so quickly that I noticed nothing of it myself. I was sometimes startled at the large leaps that my shadow made in the moonlight next to me. Around daybreak, I came to the forest above the village, and then had to go slower between the tree trunks. When I came out of the forest, it was almost sunrise. I found myself on a rocky ledge above the huts, and even these lay so far below that the great light of the morning sky had not yet reached them. Yet I could see everything perfectly. There on the place in front of the house of the king, two great fires were lit, around which a crowd of people were circling. My hopes were dashed, because it was impossible for me to go unseen into the village and discover where Teresa could be found. While I was still thinking about what I should do, the king stepped out of his hut. The people immediately drew back so that a circular shape was cleared in which the two fires burned. Between them, tied with rope, lay a human body on the ground, and I recognized Teresa. The king was greeted with a great rattle of drums and clanging of cymbals, and the warriors, placed in a circle, swung their spears and shouted his name. As he arrived at the mat on which the prisoner lay, two women with skirts of leaves and red coral necklaces between their breasts approached from the fires. Three bowls were brought up. Baked fish was in the first, in the second some type of food like bread, and in the third some cloths and mats made from palm tree fronds. After the bowls were set down in front of the king, the two women came up. Each took one of the cloths, spread it on the ground, and sat down, placing themselves in such a way that their faces were turned to the east, which was already so light that you could expect to see the sun any minute. One of the women carried a trumpet out of reeds in her hand. The other carried a stone knife. They stood that way for a while without moving, until the sun lifted its edge over the horizon. Then the woman blew three blasts on her trumpet and began to sing in a loud voice, to which the other answered. This back and forth singing continued until the sun had completely risen. Then the first woman wrapped one of the cloths around her head and slowly began to walk around the body lying on the ground. The other wrapped a binding around her forehead and followed the first at the same pace. Then they changed places. The first threw away her cloth and took up a binding, while the second wrapped her head completely. Then they threw away the bindings and the cloths and continued to dance around the prisoner, and then once more exchanged places. I saw the gleaming naked breasts and the red coral necklaces swinging back and forth between them. This dance lasted for a very long time, until the king gave a signal with his hand. Then the first woman came up close to him and received a bowl filled with palm wine. She turned back to dancing, put the shell up to her lips 3 or 4 times without drinking, and finally, with a swing, poured a little out over Teresa's breast. At the same moment, the second dancer rushed at Teresa and stabbed her stone knife 2 times into her heart. The clanging and drumming became a great noise. The first woman touched the tip of her trumpet into the flowing blood and sprayed it out over the people, not any differently than our priests do with holy water. I watched all this in a condition that robbed me of all my will, and only my ability to think remained, so that while I reproached myself strongly for my cowardice, at the same time I realized that no help in the world could tear Teresa away from her fate. I don't know what happened in the village after that. I left the place and slowly returned through the forest and over the plain back to our camp. I made no attempt at being careful, because I didn't care if I was discovered or not. As I reached the ash heap of the Golden City, I found Don Pedro in a state of great agitation about me, but I gave him no answer to his question of where I had been. Then a terrible hatred against him filled me completely. The devil whispered to me that he was the one responsible for Teresa's death. I sat down on the ground, and when my hand touched the grass, Satan stabbed me with Teresa's stone knife. Then I was compelled to immediately stand back up again. I stepped up to Pedro with the knife in my hand, and without knowing what I was doing, stabbed the knife into his breast 2 times. In this you can see that the devil was guiding my hand, not my own will. Pedro collapsed and cried, "Brother, what have you done?" and passed away. I only came back to my senses after his death, and knew that because of what had happened, the Lord and all his saints had abandoned me. The few empty pages that I have used for this manuscript are coming to an end, and I must hurry to say that what is still to be said. I dug a grave for Don Pedro at the foot of the cross, before which we had performed our services, and lowered him into it. Then I took his prayer book with me and left the place, which the natives rightfully take as a dwelling place of demons. I headed for the coast, determined to either die or leave the island. During the following night, I succeeded in taking a boat, unnoticed, despite the placed guards, and arrived on the high seas. After many adventures and dangers, and after even more hungry days, the wind drove me onto this little island, which, according to the speech of the occupants, belongs to the kingdom of Cipango, and where these harmless and friendly people have taken good care of me. After a short stay, I fell into a high fever which left me very weak, which always returns, and I know with full certainty will bring my death. Yet I don't want to die without first writing down my experiences on the island of Zubu. I have prepared the ink myself, write with the pen of reed, and the heathens of this island see me as a great sorcerer. This manuscript serves not as a report to the world, because it will never come before those eyes, but is instead for myself alone. I have determined, as soon as it is finished, to turn my thoughts to my days on Zubu and spend the rest of my days in prayer and penance for the salvation of my soul as I await my death. But if this should ever come into the hands of a Christian, I repeat my plea first expressed at the beginning and close in the same way as I began. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen. And that is the story for this week. Goodbye.